Welcome to Pandanomics, a series exploring the economic impact of the COVID-19 pandemic and what the coming months may hold for Canadians. My name is Stephen Maurice. I'm the editor of Scotiabank Perspectives. Today, I'm joined by Derek Holt, Vice President and Head of Capital Markets Economics at Scotiabank. Derek leads the application of economic and financial market forecasts and research to the needs of Scotiabank's global institutional investor clients and major bank clients. You can follow his analysis, including his great Global Week Ahead, on the economics page at scotiabank.com. Welcome to Pandanomics, Derek.
Thanks very much, Stephen.
All right, so two big stories obviously have dominated the news for the last couple of weeks. Those would be the U.S. election and the huge spike in COVID cases across the U.S. and in many parts of Canada. And we'll get to those in a minute, but I wanted to start with sort of a basic layman's big picture question about the stock markets. And that is, I was just looking at some of the charts of the big exchanges going back to before COVID. And when you look at those, it looks like the recovery has very much taken that V shape that we talked about so much in the early days of the pandemic, with most markets basically having rebounded to the highs that they were seeing back in February and early March. But I was wondering, given the ongoing financial difficulties that individuals and businesses are experiencing, how closely do those market recoveries reflect what's been happening in people's real lives? Do those markets know something that the rest of us don't?
Well, that's a great way to start off, Stephen. And I think the first point is that what's going on in the stock markets is a poor gauge of what's currently happening on the Main Street economy at many times in history. And so there are several points I'd like to emphasize. For one thing, stock markets tend to be more forward looking. So when the worst news is hitting Main Street, stock markets are already pricing a recovery 6+ months down the road. And so I think that's why we saw the stock market bottom back in March and start to price in a recovery well ahead of time. Secondly, we've had massive amounts of policy supports from governments and central banks. They've provided a number of important programs to support incomes to keep the economy going as much as possible. And central banks slashed borrowing costs and flooded the world with money supply. And that led to this support to the markets overall. I think it's also useful to point out that not all parts of the stock market have been negatively hit by the pandemic. There was a large amount of tech spending that lifted tech stocks. We saw healthcare stocks perform well. Some defensive sectors that provide relative safety in uncertain periods, like utilities, also generally performed better. An additional point that really starts to get practical in terms of investment choices for individual investors merits noting that you really don't have that many other choices compared to the stock market right now. Investing in a 10-year U.S. government bond, for example, gives you a rate of return of less than 1%. The dividend yield on the S&P 500, the biggest measure for the U.S. stock market, is almost 1.75%. So just on dividends, even if you didn't make any capital gains, you're better off investing in stocks than bonds, you know, depending upon the individual investor. So I'd say in a big picture sense, it's not so much the valuations that concern me, and the stock market is forward-looking relative to these other choices.
So should that be reason for optimism for the average person while they see, you know, still some measure of disquiet around the economy and particularly with the renewed spike in cases, which we'll get to in a bit. But if the markets are forward looking and they're looking, I don't know, 2, 3, 6, 8 months down the road, if investors appear to be optimistic, is that grounds for optimism for regular people, maybe, who are not paying that much attention to the daily movements of the stock market?
Yeah, and that's a very good place to be during these times. But I think you're right. It's an important point to emphasize that the stock market is sending a relatively optimistic signal to people that this isn't going to be with us forever and that we're getting massive government and central bank supports in the background to help us ease the adjustment period. And what I think markets are particularly emphasizing right now is the prospect for vaccines to become readily available. Probably, in my opinion, in massive numbers, more toward the second half of next year, by the time they get approved by regulators, by the time enough is produced and distributed, and we need to see enough people actually accepting the vaccines and taking them. And that's probably not a story until the second half of next year at the earliest, in my view.
For sure. And we'll come back to that, to both COVID and the news around vaccines. It was two of them, Pfizer and then Moderna, coming out with some very positive outlooks for their vaccines. And we'll come back to some of the COVID-related stuff in a minute. I just want to touch on the election. Joe Biden seems to have won a pretty convincing victory, even though Donald Trump so far is refusing to accept that he lost. How are markets responding to this unusual political situation in the U.S.? And I say that recognizing that, you know, markets respond to different things. It's hard to pinpoint exactly what they're responding to. And there's that, I guess, that crossover between what's going on the COVID side and what's going on the political side. But is it possible to read tea leaves around the political situation in terms of how the market's reacting?
I think so, with a lot of caution, because right now we have promises about election platforms. We need to see what actually gets implemented going forward. But to me, the biggest thing that the markets are paying attention to right now concerns the fact that they like checks and balances in government. And right now they are seeing that the Biden administration is probably going to be somewhat checked in all likelihood by a Republican-led Senate. That's yet to be fully determined. We'll find out after the two runoffs in the Senate in Georgia in early January. But the Democrats would have to win both of those in order to secure control of the Senate, which is maybe a stretch. But right now, it's what that scenario says to the markets is that if you get these checks and balances, you will get some stimulus, but maybe not blow out the lights type of stimulus that could concern bond markets, and that could put upward pressure upon borrowing costs and maybe cause the Federal Reserve to ultimately reassess its promise to be on hold for many years to come if we wind up getting massive amounts of spending by governments into the next year. I think markets are also looking at the likelihood that we'll get more stable U.S. trade policies with the Biden administration, fewer trade wars, a bit of repair to the relationships with allies. What he does to trade policy later on is more uncertain, particularly with respect to his appetite for carbon tariffs. But the markets will deal with that later on in the administration. And so they may also be emphasizing how a Biden administration could manage a crisis somewhat more competently than the previous administration. And so it's an overall combination of probably more stimulus, more stable trade policy, and a bit better crisis management leading this.
I think you had framed that hope perhaps on the part of the markets around what will happen with the Senate as a blue light versus blue wave scenario. I don't know if that's your own wording that you made up, or if that's some phrasing that's just going around. But it's an interesting way of expressing how the market likes to see some balance there, that they don't want to see one side or the other dominating all aspects of policymaking.
I think so. I mean, the blue wave scenario where they control all the main levers of power in Washington, the Senate, the House, and the Oval Office, would be something that I think would be a bit concerning to the bond market, and hence the impact upon household and business borrowing costs that could be under relatively greater upward pressure if it winds up fanning an earlier and much, much faster pace of growth into the next year than is currently priced. And that would unfold as a consequence to Biden's economic plan over the next decade, where he seeks to increase spending by about $5.25 trillion and to raise about $3.25 trillion worth of additional tax revenues. And so it's a pretty sizable amount of net stimulus that would be thrown onto the U.S. economy that is already generally in recovery mode. So that would be welcome from a growth standpoint, from the standpoint of workers and currently still unemployed individuals. It would be very, very welcome. But to the markets, they'd look at that as, well, OK, is the Federal Reserve still going to be able to promise that it's on hold for 3-4 years off into the future if you get that amount of massive fiscal stimulus?
Right. And so are you able to explain a little bit again for the layperson such as myself, but how that plays out and what the impacts are? I guess that combination of stimulus in the form of fiscal policy and how central banks are reacting in terms of monetary policy and liquidity and so on. And, you know, people talk about bond yields. Are you able to explain a little bit how those things work together and how they ultimately impact, again, sort of regular people in their lives in terms of interest rates and other things?
Yeah, sure thing. So the generally speaking, the more stimulus that is provided, the faster the near-term growth is likely to be. And so then markets start to anticipate the potential for central banks like the Federal Reserve, the Bank of Canada, and other central banks around the world to be raising interest rates. And so they act in advance of that by demanding higher interest rates now for 1, 2, 3, 5 year costs of borrowing. And that could impact, say, 5 year cost of mortgage rates in the Canadian context. If we wind up overheating the economy into 2021 with very, very aggressive spending plans. And so the Biden administration wants to increase spending on education by almost $2 trillion, on water and high-speed rail and clean energy and various green projects by about $1.5 trillion. The big uncertainty to those types of spending amounts is how fast he's going to try to target these increased budgets and over what time horizons. It's from a market standpoint, they prefer a Goldilocks scenario. Not too hot, not too cold. You generate some growth in the near term, but don't spook the markets by causing these abrupt changes in policy that can lead to sudden changes in stocks and bond markets.
And does levels of government debt factor into those views on the part of the markets and investors? I mean, Trump has increased the federal debt in the United States substantially over the course of his term. Now it looks like Biden's plans for spending are even more ambitious or aggressive, or however you want to look at it. Are there concerns around that? And I guess I could ask the same question around Canada as well.
It's a very good question, because I think this also relates back to what our Prime Minister, Justin Trudeau, cautioned just the other day when he said, in so many words, you know, the ability of governments to respond and to counter these forces in the economy is not unlimited. And so they've done an awful amount so far. They've done reacted to among the most aggressive degrees in across Canadian governments that we've seen anywhere in the world. And they've been very, very speedy in their response, generally speaking. But the trade-off becomes the more you expect in terms of spending and bridging mechanisms to get us past this crisis, the bigger the debt burden down the road. Well, the bigger the debt burden down the road, the more likely it is that we have to pay for that in one form or another. And that could represent tax burdens on future generations. It could mean spending reductions in future, like what we experienced back in the 90s in Canada, when we had to get back to balanced budgets fairly quickly after many, many years of spending beyond our means. And so right now, that's not a concern to the markets. They realize that every government around the world is in the same position. Central banks are keeping borrowing costs very, very low. But as the years go by into the future, I think you're going to see much, much more emphasis upon that debt burden and how to pay for it all. And you need to be careful about how much you do now with an eye on that issue further down the road.
So again, maybe are you able to explain why such significant levels of debts for most people, for many economists and certainly in governments, they make the case that that we can afford this, that tripling or quadrupling the level of annual deficit, or more than that even, that in this particular time period that we're in, that's okay. Can you what's the rationale behind that for people who were maybe saw sort of the problems in the 90s that you were just talking about, and at other times debts and deficits, they always mattered in the past, and now for many people they seem to not so much.
Sure. Okay. So I think one issue now versus the 1990s is the fact that back then there were many more sources of competition for global savings, and governments were, and particularly in Canada, leaning heavily upon their appetite for those savings in a way that was, causing interest rates to be under some upward pressure, certainly if we remember the environment of the early 1990s. Today, there is a glut of global savings activity. We've seen spending retrench. Generally speaking, saving rates go up across the entire world. And so from a policy standpoint, that's not a bad point in time at which governments can step into the market and say, okay, everybody else is saving, businesses aren't investing as much, consumers aren't buying as much as they may have been before the pandemic, depending upon the type of consumption. So we're going to soak up some of those short-term savings and redeploy them in the economy to try to bridge over this soft patch that we've been going through and the ongoing uncertainty. And so the problem is you can't do that indefinitely, because eventually investment is going to come back, consumption is going to come back, and if governments are still borrowing heavily in that environment with no plan to get back toward balanced budgets, then everybody's competing for a shrinking pool of savings some point further on down the road. And that starts to put upward pressure upon the cost of those savings. So what it costs to borrow in the market. And that's not an issue now, but we have to plan now with an eye on the future risk in that sense.
Finally, I mean, we've been talking about COVID in the context of various things we've talked about, but specifically now we seem to have competing or maybe not contradictory, but two things going on at once that might lead to different attitudes around what's going on. So you've got big spikes going on all over the place, rather terrifying in some places. And at the same time, we have this great news about vaccines that appear to be very effective. So to judge by stock markets, it looks like they are on the optimistic side of that equation. Again, how far down the road are they looking? Is everybody still anticipating some volatility over the course of the next few months as we sort of get through this? And then what role does perhaps a different approach by a new U.S. administration in trying to tackle the pandemic play in that? To judge by the stock markets, they seem happy and thrilled that these vaccines look to be coming out at some point.
Right. Yeah. No, there's no doubt that the road ahead is littered with a number of risks along the path to ultimately a sustainable recovery. In the relatively near term, we also have to get past issues such as the fact that on December 11th, the U.S. government funding arrangements expire. And so there's the renewed risk of a government shutdown in the context of what is so far rather uncooperative Trump administration in the transition period. We also have to deal with the December 31st expiration of a number of forms of U.S. stimulus for jobless benefits. The eviction moratorium also expires along that time horizon. And again, to what degree will we see a Trump administration and the incoming Biden administration cooperate in order to manage these risks and to extend funding and to extend some of these forms of stimulus? Then we get into the issue of vaccines and how long-lived this COVID-19 shock will be. And it may well be that stock markets are being too optimistic right now because we still have to seek regulatory approval for whatever vaccine or vaccines ultimately prove to be successful or the most successful. We have to see them being produced in sufficient numbers. They have to be distributed, and the Moderna announcement was much more favorable in that sense because you can refrigerate it for at least 30 days, which tackles a big distribution challenge. But then we also have to overcome the psychological or individual barriers to accepting the vaccine, given how fast this was pursued. And that requires enough take-up across the population to achieve sufficient herd immunity. And so by the time you get all of these things lining up, I still think it's second half 2021, if not longer, before we get all the stars aligned. And I'm cautiously optimistic that by that point, we'll have in place the seeds for a sustained recovery and we'll be able to beat this virus or at least manage it much more capably. But it's going to be a bumpy ride for investors, certainly along that path.
Okay, which leads me to my last dumb question. That's my job, is to ask the dumb questions and you give the smart answers. So can you explain to me what risk on and risk off mean? And given what you just said, which one of those would you say we are in now?
Yeah, sure. And no, you've asked very good questions. So give yourself a little bit more support there. That's been fantastic. Okay, so risk on generally means when stocks are rising, most commodity prices tend to be benefiting from expectations for strong global growth and demand for those commodities. It can be an environment in which some relatively riskier currencies, in other words, not the US dollar, not the Swiss franc, not the Japanese yen, tend to be doing well. And that can be an environment in which currencies like the Canadian dollar tend to be rising in value. It can also mean, however, for bond investors that they don't generally do so well in that environment because basically, in a nutshell, bonds love bad news. More than they appreciate good news. And so when they start to see growth expectations rise, inflation expectations rise, you tend to, all things controlled and considered, tend to experience a bit of a capital loss or an investment loss on a bond, whereas stocks would benefit in that kind of an environment. So that's generally what's meant by that kind of terminology.
Great. Thank you for clearing that up for me. And thank you for doing this, Derek. I really appreciate it. And this was very, very interesting. I appreciate you clearing up many of those things for us.
Well, it's a pleasure, Stephen. And welcome 2021. Let's get this one behind us.
All right. I've been speaking with Derek Holt, Vice President and Head of Capital Markets Economics at Scotiabank. Thank you for listening to Panonomics. If you're enjoying the podcast, please subscribe on Apple or Google Podcasts. And thanks again for listening.